What I want to propose is that you're living in a time when there is really amazing, and you might even say unprecedented, ecumenical agreement, ecumenical consensus about a lot of things in Christian life. The ecumenical movement began with the missionary movement, as you may know, in the early years of this century, when missionaries in Africa, let's say, representing Methodist churches and Roman Catholic churches and Lutheran churches and so on, found themselves setting up shop, you might say, right down the road from each other in Africa, and comparing notes and deciding, my goodness, who's going to believe Christians if they're so divided? You know what I mean? So the ecumenical movement began 1910, 1918, and then spread around the world. And since then, the churches have been in conversation, a lot of the churches anyhow, and come up with really some amazing agreements, some amazing consensus. Granted, it's not a complete consensus, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes, but it's enough to give me great, encouragement. As I say, I don't think we've seen this kind of an agreement since before the Reformation. Now, my field is worship, and that's my interest. I've been teaching at Waterloo Seminary in Waterloo, Ontario, Waterloo Lutheran Seminary, one of two Lutheran seminaries in Canada. Waterloo, Ontario is about an hour this side of Toronto. And it's the German heartland of Canada, so a lot of Germans and a lot of Lutherans. And as I say, what I have been teaching is worship, church architecture, church music, that kind of thing. And I've been dean of the chapel. So I think you could even say that this consensus or this agreement extends to other areas of the church's life as well. Doctrine and creed and belief and how we ought to act on that, how we ought to live, our ethics, our code of behavior and so on. Even things like church structure and church organization, there's a lot of agreement in those areas as well. But one of the exciting things in the last couple of years has been the development of this document. This is called Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry. And it comes at things from a theological point of view. I'm going to take it into a little more practical avenue here this afternoon. But you should know that this document is put out by the World Council of Churches, and it represents agreement on behalf of, are you ready for this? Eastern Orthodox, Oriental Orthodox, Roman Catholic, Old Catholic, Lutheran, Anglican, Reformed, Methodist, United, Disciples, Baptist, Adventist, and Pentecostal. Can you imagine that? All of those churches had leaders and theologians and pastors and lay people who contributed to the making of this document. And what it is a series of little paragraphs, and they're numbered, and you can read it in the course of an evening, and they're now study guides to this document. What is baptism all about, and how should we do it? What is Eucharist, Holy Communion, all about, and how should we do it? And even ministry, what is ministry from Bible times to now? So, I'm here to tell you that you're living in a time that we have not seen since before the Reformation. Because there is this really astounding and welcome, in my view, welcome ecumenical consensus. I have a little essay in this volume, What is Contemporary Worship? It's volume 2 in a series of pamphlets, Open Questions in Worship. And they have both of these in the bookstore, if you want to take a look.
Would you mind passing them around?
Pardon?
Would you mind passing them around now?
Yeah, sure. There's no reason why not.
Yeah,
take a look. Anyhow, let's begin by, let me quote Kathy Survey. I haven't done that for a while. My wife, Kathy, teaches other courses here this year, this week. And she is a family life educator. And she came home from a conference a couple years ago with the results of a survey. I've got to the age where I need these things. She came home with a survey that had been done of married couples. And among all the things that they studied in this survey, they were most interested in this. Did the married couple embrace and kiss before they separated to go their way in the morning to work? And when they came back after work, did they embrace and kiss? That was the single variable that they were most interested in, although they studied a whole lot of things. And they concluded something that should not surprise church people who go to church every Sunday. Namely, that the people, the couples, that embraced and kissed before they separated in the morning and when they came back after they had been separated for a while, those couples that embraced and kissed had happier marriages, longer lasting marriages, more fulfilling marriages than the couples that did not embrace and kiss. And as I say, that should not surprise Christian people who go to church every Sunday. And the really significant part of the survey was this, and this kind of blew me away. It did not seem to matter whether or not they meant it. I mean, there are days like that, right? I'm going to kiss you because Jesus wants me to. You know, we get each other mad, and it can be very perfunctory. But even the perfunctory doing of it made a difference. Now, what we're talking here this afternoon is shop talk, in a sense. I read a wonderful book, Rogers' Version. Have you read John Updike at all? Are you a fan of John Updike? He's a favorite of mine. Anyhow, he writes a book about a seminary professor who had been a parish pastor. Roger is the hero of the book, and he tells a story. And at one point, he's in conversation with his niece. And his niece says, Uncle Roger, you're a salesman, aren't you, essentially? A salesman for a religion? And he said, well, when I was in the parish, I was a salesman. But he says, now that I'm teaching at seminary, I'm in quality control. And I kind of like that, too, you know? So what we're doing here today is not so much sales as quality control. In other words, we're doing shop talk. And this is not the kind of thing I would preach in a sermon, but I think it's interesting and useful, and I think church people ought to know this. Pastors ought to know this. Church council people ought to know this. Worship committee people ought to know this. Simply interested and informed lay people ought to know this. Okay, so this all began, where did it begin? It began, as I say, with the ecumenical movement as missionaries began to develop that, working side by side in foreign countries and decided it was terrible that they gave the appearance of competing with each other. And shortly after the Second World War, in the early 50s, there was a wonderful movement of people who were interested in church architecture and church music and worship generally across the denominations. Again, Lutherans, Anglicans, Roman Catholics, Presbyterians, Methodists. And they began to go to conferences together and to talk to each other. And they began to ask the same questions and they began to come up with the same answers. And then along came Pope John the 23rd, wonderful person, elected, when would it have been, 1961 or 62, something like that, kind of as a caretaker pope. I think he was very old. Was he in his 80s even when he was elected pope? They thought he would just kind of keep the shop open until they could get the real pope they wanted. But he surprised everybody because he called the Ecumenical Council. And at the Ecumenical Council, they invited representatives from other denominations. So there were Lutheran representatives there, and Anglican, and Presbyterian, and Methodist, and so on. And the first document to come out of the Vatican Council was the document on the liturgy and worship. And if you may recall, if you have Roman Catholic friends, instantly, overnight, I think the year was 1971 when they put this all into effect, overnight, on the first Sunday of Advent, 1971, every Roman Catholic altar came out from the wall. The priest stood behind it, and the Mass was now
English.
In English, right. It was in the language of the people. I mean, Martin Luther wanted some of those things, right? So you're living in an age, people are going to look back 100, 200 years from now, they're going to look back at your age, and they're going to say, wow, how exciting it must have been to be alive then. Scary. I mean, not easy. Scary, but very exciting. Anyhow, it's a wide agreement, I would say, a wide accord. It's not unanimous. You should know that there are three rather significant voices, you might say, that would not agree with what I'm going to tell you today. One of them would be the so-called church growth movement. Robert Schuller and Garden Grove Cathedral, you know, Crystal Cathedral and all that. Robert Schuller and others invented some years ago now, and they lead workshops on it, the so-called church growth movement, which tries to target certain populations of people. And it takes market research out of the business world, out of business and industry, and applies market research to church life and to religion. And it tries to design worship, you might say, to meet the needs of those secular people out there, which is laudable enough from one standpoint, but if that's your only consideration, as Martin Marty says, you are letting those people who know the least about faith determine the most about its expression. You see what I mean? So there's some major problems, I think, with the church growth movement. And they're big churches now, the mega churches. There's a great one, you know, Minneapolis, St. Paul has a great big one, and the Chicago area has a great big one, and there's one in
Florida,
Phoenix, Arizona, and so on. They have a lot of people, but I think they're going in the wrong direction. And we can talk about that in a few minutes if you want to. Anyhow, the church growth people generally, and entertainment evangelism, and the mega church type mentality, that, as I say, would not agree with what I'm presenting today. They're going in another direction. Cardinal Ratzinger, as you might guess, is going in another direction. Cardinal Ratzinger has the present Pope's ear, and the present Pope is a very winsome, energetic fellow, but he's no John the 23rd, and he's very much more conservative and very much more, very much less enthusiastic about the reforms of the Second Vatican Council. Cardinal Ratzinger, who is in charge of the Congregation for the Defense of the Faith, or whatever they call it, he has written an introduction to a book arguing that we ought to put the altar back against the wall again and have the priest face with his back to the people. So he would not agree, and there's a big part of Roman Catholicism that thinks those reforms from Vatican II were a big mistake and we ought to turn back the clock and so on. So they would not agree. And finally, there's also that mentality, of course, among some Protestants in Anglicanism and the Church of England. In England, they have what is called the Prayer Book Society, and they have such people in this country, too. These are people, again, largely conservative, who want to keep the wording of the old Book of Common Prayer. You know, thee and thou and beseech and all that Shakespearean language. And the new Anglican book looks just like our book. but these people, the Prayer Book Society, think that's a mistake. And we should retain that old Shakespearean English. So they would not agree with some of these reforms or some of this consensus. But having said that, let's move on to the consensus itself. We're still not into the meat of it. We'll get to the meat of it when I get to 1, 2, 3, and 4. But let's talk about phenomenology for a minute, because that's been the exciting, the frontier in worship studies these days. Phenomenology is the study of phenomenon. I mean, it's the study and the it can be very, you know, complicated and esoteric and so on. But it's a study of how things appear. Last week I gave the example of phenomenology. I was very naughty one day when we first moved to Ontario. Kitchener-Waterloo are kind of like twin cities, a big metropolitan area. And we attended a big downtown Lutheran church where they were having communion on this Sunday. This was in the first couple of weeks that we had moved into town. And they were having communion, and it was the custom there to fill out a little blue card that you were communing. And then when you came up to the altar for communion, for the bread and the cup, you were to give this card to an usher who stood at the foot of the steps there. And as I say, I felt kind of naughty this day, and I did not fill out a card, and I came up empty-handed, and I whispered to the usher, "Can I get up there without a ticket?" You see, the phenomenology of the situation is it looks like you had to have a ticket, you see, to get the bread and the cup. And there ought to be a better way to take attendance, that's my feeling. Okay, that's phenomenology. And that's where the excitement is. That's where the frontier is these days in the study of worship. Interestingly, it's not from three other sources, four other sources really. It's not from history, it's not from theology narrowly understood, it's not from aesthetics, the finer things in life, and it's not from market research. Let's take each one of those for a minute. Back in the old days when I went to seminary, and that's 44 years ago, friends, I'm 65, just had my 40th anniversary of ordination this year, as a matter of fact. Back when I went to seminary, we taught, the professor of liturgy, of worship, taught from a historical standpoint. In other words, he said, this is what happened in the primitive church, and this is what happened with St. Augustine of Hippo, and this is what happened in the Reformation, and you had the Mozarabic Rite, and you had the reforms of Gregory, the Pope who invented Gregorian chant, and all that kind of stuff. And that's still being done, and that's still very important, and they've given us a lot of insights. But that's not where the fun or the excitement is these days in worship. Further, the excitement is not from theology narrowly understood. Again, Cardinal Ratzinger would want to say the theology of liturgy is when the priest does this, this is what it means, you know, that kind of thing. That's going into the theology of it. Aesthetics, too, was another part of it. The finer things in life. My teacher at seminary, you may know the name Luther Reed, and I went to Philadelphia Seminary, and George Seltzer, but I think the same could be said of Walter Buzin and what was his name, Arthur Carl Peepcorn at Concordia. These were people who were very cultured, and they knew the difference between good architecture and bad architecture. And they tried to teach us country boys, it was all boys back in those days, they tried to teach us country boys the difference between good and bad architecture and good and bad poetry and good and bad music. And they were interested in the finer things in life. And interestingly, a little autobiographical note here, when I was a kid, I was always interested in the arts. I mean, I sang in the choir in high school and college or university. I acted in the plays. I was interested in drawing and painting and sculpture and architecture and going to art galleries and so on. And I didn't exactly think that was naughty for faith or you know, that faith didn't have anything to do with that. But I never put that together with faith until, are you ready for this, 5 years after I was ordained. I was already a minister 5 years before it dawned on me that the place where all of these arts engage with faith is 11 o'clock Sunday morning, worship. In other words, at worship you are dealing with this architectural space. And if not this, then simply some other, can't do away with it. You're dealing with these poems, these poetic and literary texts. You're dealing with this music, these gestures, these postures, these vestments and so on. You see what I mean? And if not these, then certainly some others. You know, you cannot do away with liturgy. And my argument would be everybody's got a liturgy. I lived in Kentucky 2 years ago. I was visiting professor at Berea College. Any of you know Berea College? Wonderful place. And we went to an old regular Baptist church one Sunday morning. 3-hour service, are you ready for this? 5 sermons, singing, constant singing, and not a hymn book. And they would say they were a non-liturgical church, but everybody knew what was going on, and they knew those hymns, let me tell you. They read the Bible, and they prayed, and there were sermons. I mean, there was a liturgy there. It wasn't our liturgy, but I mean, it was, the people were used to it. Okay, so it's not from aesthetics, the finer things in life, although, as I say, I found my vocation there 4 years after I was ordained. It's not significantly from market research, the church growth movement, that kind of thing, looking at what's the market out there and let's target our advertising to attract the baby boomers or whatever. It is from cultural anthropology and phenomenology, and you might say ritual studies. And if you know the name Van Gennep or Durkheim or Victor Turner or Marcia Iliada from the University of Chicago, these are people who have been the ones who have opened up the door to this relatively new field of study. And the school that I have most recently been associated with, Wilfrid Laurier University in Canada, Laurier is the name of one of the previous prime ministers. There's a fellow who teaches at the school in the religion department who is an international authority on ritual studies, and he goes into North American Navajo kivas and sweat lodges and stuff like that with the Indians, and he writes up then, you know, this is their liturgy, this is their ritual, and here's the way the Northwest Coast Indians do it, and here's the way they do it over in Africa. Or he is a student, in other words, of anthropology, but narrowly religious and ritual anthropology, ritual studies. And he's written books on it, and he goes all over the world giving lectures on it. He talks about there being ritual times and ritual occasions and ritual people. There are rituals of status conferral. I suppose that could be confirmation. There are rituals of cleansing. I suppose that could be the order for public confession. You see what I mean? They describe this, in other words, from an anthropological, phenomenological viewpoint. And what is the century of emulation for these people? Curiously, the people who wrote the Green Book, for instance, what century do they look back to as being useful for today? Well, it's the 4th century, as a matter of fact. Now, that's quite different from the so-called Oxford movement of 1930, 1940, 1950, when you had, particularly in Oxford and in England, but elsewhere in Europe and even in North America, you had scholars saying, the real age of faith was the 12th century. And you had the Gothic cathedrals being built, Chartres and Mont-Saint-Michel and Notre Dame, and you have Gothic windows with a pointed arch, and you have stained glass, and you have a long axial church with the pews ranked up and a divided chancel with the choir on both sides singing perpendicular to the axis, and you have an east wall altar, and every church in Christendom had to look like that back in 1920, 1930. And Oxford movement type buildings, big and small, were built all over Western Europe and all over North America. And these were people who looked back to the 12th century as the age of faith. Well, ask Martin Luther about that. He didn't think much of the church life in the Middle Ages, with some good reasons. And there are Lutherans, therefore, who would say, well, let's look back to the 16th century as the most helpful time for us. Let's try to do today what Luther did. Or the theologians and the systematicians right after Martin Luther. Well, that has its usefulness, too. I'm not knocking it. It's helpful. But the people who wrote this book or put it together, and the people who are writing the stuff that you have in your hands here that I've just been circulating, they look back to the 4th century. And they say Christendom, the time of the Constantinian era, that's over. You may know that Constantine was the emperor in the 4th century who not only became a Christian himself, but then baptized people with a fire hose, you might say. Like it or not, you're going to get baptized. And he made the Christian faith the official state church, you might say, the religion of the empire. And that was a major change. And now, instead of being persecuted, the Christian church had power and prestige and privilege. And it did not have it before. So, the people who wrote this book and who wrote these volumes, they are saying, boy, we live in a pretty secular world. We may call ourselves a Christian nation, but I'll bet there's a big missionary opportunity in North America as much as there is in Africa or Asia. And we are living in a post-Constantinian, post-Christendom era. I would never talk about the age being post-Christian. You sometimes hear people talk about, oh, we live in a post-Christian era. No age is post-Christian. But I think you could say it is post-Christendom in the sense of established churches where everybody knows the Bible stories, everybody knows the theology. Did everybody ever know all that? I'm not sure. In any case, we are in a very secular world here. And I heard this, incidentally. I heard that the Northwest, that is Oregon and Washington, are the most secular parts of the country. Have you heard that before? You've heard that yourself, yeah. Anyhow, it is certainly true that, people today, a lot of people out there in the street, do not know the Bible stories, do not know Christian teaching, don't know anything about Jesus and Mary and the wise men and the crucifixion and all that. We have to begin as if we are back in the 3rd or 4th century. So, I thought that was kind of interesting to know. Let's take a look now at the four, what I'm calling the four qualities or the four characteristics of this ecumenical consensus. And then we'll just have an open conversation. I've been going, about a half an hour? Let me go another 15 minutes or so, and then we'll... You can interrupt me if you'd like to along the way. Anyone want to talk to your neighbor? Yeah, sure, do that. Talk to your neighbor for a minute. I'll give you a minute and a half. And then I'll blow the whistle. Talk to your neighbor, and we'll have a little discussion. Does it make any sense what I'm telling you? You can even disagree with me if you want to.
Your natives there.
But his church.
I saw on this in an Acts about different states.
Oh, thank you.
That it said they're more agnostic in Washington State.
It was kind of different. People who were.
Really don't know the stories, and coming there searching for them, I think there's just native spirituality in people. Because they were escaping their family, they were escaping their culture back there.
I mean, a little bit of identity, a little bit of a campfire gathering, where everybody's welcome, everybody's just good, positive feeling kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Without a lot of emphasis on confession or forgiveness
or the
relationship with Jesus through the rest of the week. Feel good. Kind of
another half minute? Okay, can we call time? What did you come up with? Want to share? You don't have to. I don't want to pull it out of you, but if you would like to say something, I'm willing to take a little break.
Well, how do we develop liturgy that worship is worship of God, but at the same time meets those needs? One of the things that you pointed out here is that I suspect that when this liturgy is being developed and the hymns, you still have a number of people who are part of that movement, part of that church, who understood those stories, so that in a sense you could, it was kind of those markers back here where you pointed out, I think, an important point that, our society has gone so far the other direction because of a number of sociological kinds of reasons. Nobody understands the stories.
A lot of education necessary, including worship education. Why do we do stuff the way we do? I don't think we have to apologize that what happens on Sunday morning is a little different from David Letterman, let's say, or Jay Leno, or Oprah. It's not a talk show. It's not a rock concert, what happens in church. And I don't think we have to apologize for that. We probably do have to interpret it, though. You're right. We have to spend a lot more energy than maybe we used to because all of those secularists out there. telling the Bible stories, interpreting what we do, making it accessible. Three wonderful terms that come out of a recent study from the Lutheran World Federation. At the world level, the Lutherans, and some others too, are going into a study of worship and the culture, and they're talking about enculturation, or encultural worship, countercultural worship, or aspects of worship, and then transcultural. And boy, each of those I think is helpful. There's a sense in which, am I spelling that right? Yeah. There's a sense in which we have to enculturate the gospel. In other words, putting the mass in the language of the people. That's enculturating. You're trying to take the forms and the stuff that people are used to in that culture and make the gospel make sense in their terms. And you got to do that in every generation. I suppose every generation has to have a new translation of the Bible, and every generation has to have a new hymn book. Just because life changes and language changes. So that's one aspect. We want to make it make sense as much as possible. But there's also a countercultural aspect to what we do. We don't want to simply baptize everything out there in the culture. You know, how about all that consumerism in America? How about the infanticide in Africa, or the six wives, you know, that you might find that one man has? You know, do you want to baptize all of that? There ought to be a countercultural witness in our worship and in our faith and preaching. And then transcultural, that's a reminder that the faith that we have transcends all the cultures. Reminders of that are the fact that we still use, for instance, Jewish and even Greek terms in our liturgy. You know, the Hosanna, what does that mean? Hallelujah, what does that mean? Amen, what does that mean? You have to translate that stuff. We can come back to that if you want to, but let me press on and talk about these four, what I perceive as these four characteristics of the ecumenical consensus in there, in both of those little volumes. First of all, worship is understood in this consensus as participatory and not a performance. Here's where, again, we part company with the church growth people and Robert Schuller and the entertainment evangelism and so on. There's a sense in which all of those people are moving in the direction of putting on a show. And this consensus is saying, well, everybody's on stage. Everybody who attends worship ought to be invited on stage. Unfortunately, even our church architecture sometimes contributes to this perception that you're in a theater. And here sit the audience and the nave, and up here in the chancel here are the performers, and the performers are putting on a show, and the audience votes up or down and gives money in the offering plate accordingly. That's G. Kierkegaard, Søren Kierkegaard, you know that name? Philosopher and theologian, Lutheran. When? 1840s, 1860s? He criticized that kind of thing. He said, it's not as if you are an audience watching the pastor and the preacher and the organist and the choir putting on a show for you, and God is in the prompter's box whispering the cues every now and then. It's not that, he says. Everybody's on stage. Everybody's an actor. And the pastor and the musician and the choir and the preacher and so on, they're the prompters. And it's God who's in the audience. Mm-hmm. I like that. He says that's the feeling that there ought to be in worship. Now, unfortunately, it isn't always the case. But the sense that these people are promoting is the sense of a... when you walk in the door of the church, I use the term ritual contract. What's the ritual contract when you walk in the door of the church? Do you expect to sit down and be entertained, or do you expect to be one of the actors in a drama? And it ought to be the second. You ought to feel invited to be a participant. Now, you may not want to participate. You may want to just sit in that back row and observe. But you ought to feel invited. You ought to be hospitably and warmly invited to be an actor, to be a participant. I like that term, Holy Communion, because it's a collective noun. It's a reminder. The Holy Communion is the bread and the cup, sure. It's the action of eating and drinking the bread and the cup, sure, that's true. But it's also you. It's the people. You are the Holy Communion. And your voice of praise, the voice of praise of the people in the pew, that is the important voice. And the pastor and the musicians and the choir and so on, they're the cheerleaders. They're helping you praise. But the people's voice, that's the most important voice.
How do you suggest we make that warm embrace and invitation? Because it seems that if there's any point that's countercultural, that's it.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything about our society is people are looking for the good show.
Couch potatoes, yeah, sitting down with the clicker. Changing the channel.
You're actively involved here.
Yeah, yeah, that's a tough one. It requires pastors and musicians and worship leaders who know what they're doing and who do it, you know, with a certain amount of care. And I suppose it begins when you walk in the door, you know, the ushers and the greeters. Mm-hmm. Are they hospitable? And, you know, gee, we use this book here and we're going to begin on page 56, you know, that kind of thing. Sit down in the pew next to somebody, and obviously a stranger, you know, the member helps the stranger find the place in the book, stuff like that. Boy, you gotta train a congregation into doing that kind of thing. And you have to do, too, it seems to me, what this book proposes for the first time in Lutheran history, anyhow. First time in Lutheran history in North America, anyhow. And that is put lay people in significant roles of leadership. Reading the scriptures, leading the prayers, helping out in the A part, you know, the little symbols in the margin here. This book is a marvel of printing design. And a lot of other denominations look to this as a model. I mean, this is the envy. This book is the envy of a lot of other denominations. The little letter, you know, in the box here, you know, C, that means congregation. A, that means assisting minister. That means a layperson. My dad was a pastor, and every Sunday he stood up all alone. Now, this is back in the old days, of course. And he led the whole service, and he read all the responses. The people read their responses, too. But, I mean, my dad read the scriptures. He preached the sermon. He gave out the bread and the cup. You know, he did the whole thing. And you got the feeling that that's the way the people wanted it, and that they wanted my dad to be Christian for them the rest of the week. Nowadays, they're saying, let's put the lay people to work, too, on Sunday morning. Let's have them read the scriptures. Let's have them distribute the bread and the cup. Let's have them lead the prayers. Let's have them up front, too, in an aisle, just like the pastor. And I think that does give the message, boy, this is my work as well as the ordained person's work.
How many members did your dad have in his church? How many people attended?
Yeah, oh, it was 600, 700. Well, it was a big church.
Services. I'm not a pastor, but I see a real problem in churches where you have two and three services, and people talk of two and three different churches within the church.
Yeah.
And I think there's a tie-in there when they can see a layman up there participating in things and doing these things. And I think there's a factor that you haven't brought out yet, is a church paper, which also communicates an awful lot of the church.
Say your last statement again, that...
The church newspaper, I don't know what you call it.
The newsletter,
part of the communication
avenue, too. I got everything except your last statement.
I think it's part of the communication of the church to its members to bring them back in together, because there's a lot of feeling, I feel, of the larger church. We're going through it now. Our church has lost it. We see it. The people feel we've lost it because of the... of the size and the different services.
Yeah, I argue in this little book here for one service, if you can possibly do it, that has traditional and contemporary stuff both in it. And as soon as you have two services, boy, you got two different congregations. And the 9:30 people don't know the 11 o'clock people. And maybe you do, maybe you need it. I mean, maybe the size of the building, you know, maybe people can't all fit in the same building. at the same time. I mean, maybe the congregation is that big. But if you do that, then what you've got is two churches, really, two congregations. And the pastor is kind of a circuit rider, like the old Methodists, you know, with the saddlebags and the horse, except he's in the same building. And that's unfortunate. I think it would be neat if the traditional people and the contemporary people could both bump up against each other. And the old gray-haired retired folks could bump up against the families with little kids. You know, I mean, they need each other, don't they? Mm-hmm. And then I think, like to think we even like each other. You know, gray-haired people like to see those little kids. And little kids ought to see the gray hairs, too. Anyhow, that's another story. Well, it's not another story because it takes me to number two, inclusive Catholic. The term Catholic is a wonderful term, small c. We're talking small c. And it means universal, as you know. It means whole. It means complete. It means not lacking in anything. From two Greek words, kata holon, which means pertaining to the whole. Something is Catholic if it embraces all there is, embraces the whole. And that means old-timers and little kids. It means rich and poor, it means black and white, it means left-wing and right-wing and Republicans and Democrats, and, you know, that's a tough mix. I mean, a pastor who's trying to preach to that kind of a crowd has a real problem. But I think that's the Catholic Church. That's inclusive, and it should not let anybody out. It should not exclude anybody. It should welcome everybody. And that's a very diverse group of people to be working with. But I think that's our glory. That's part of our asset and not a liability, ultimately. Partly because in our tragic society that is so divided and so segregated, I heard anthropologist a couple years ago say there is no society in the world that is more segregated than North America. The teenagers all go off and do their thing, the old folks all go off and do their thing, the little kids do their thing, and they never get together. When is the only time these people come together? At the altar on Sunday morning. You know what I mean? I spent most of my life as a campus pastor. And let me tell you, the PhDs do not speak to the freshmen most of the time. And the English department does not speak to the engineering department most of the time. But on Sunday, there's at least the possibility that they might all be there in church together. And that's terrific. I mean, that's one of the few places in our North American society where you can find that kind of diversity. And it's a picture of the inclusive Catholic, small c, Catholic Church. I would argue that it is the job of all of the churches to move from more sectarian to more Catholic, small c. And that includes the Roman Catholics. They got a lot of homework. Lutherans do too, and Methodists and Pentecostals. We all got homework. And the homework that I see is a movement from being exclusive and sectarian and, you know, a kind of a spiritual lobby for some special interest to a more Catholic, whole, complete, universal ideal. But that's easier said than done. And that includes, I have a little note here, post-literate, our book-bound traditional worship. We freeze out a lot of people who can't read if we push a book in front of them all the time. And you know, here's the green book, and here's Celebrate, and here's a pamphlet of announcements, and here's the psalm. And, you know, what message are we giving phenomenologically? We're giving the message, this is going to be hard, and it's going to mean a lot of reading. Vocals at home, or if you never learned how to read, you know, you're in trouble here. And you aren't going to like it. And I don't like it very much, but let's turn to page 56. I mean, you know, some pastors are like that. Anyhow, let's try to do away with the book. You were going to say something.
It also limits the ages. I mean, kids can't...
They haven't learned to read yet. Exactly. Yeah, we should. And I've heard somebody say, this is kind of a gross analogy, but children are the miner's canary of worship. You know how the miners used to bring a canary down in the mine, and if the canary died, they knew that the air was bad and they had to get out. terrible analogy. But if children are bored or restless in worship, then something's wrong. We ought to have worship that's lively and that includes them. Now, it also ought to include the gray hairs. But if we're really Catholic, small c, we want to include everybody, even the little kids. Moving along. Sacramental and incarnational. I think there is a consensus that worship on Sunday morning ought to be the full banquet. Word and sacrament. Lutherans for a long time have talked about word and sacrament, and this document makes some amazing strides in the old argument, well, is it transubstantiation, is it just a symbol, all of that stuff now is under the table, and it's forgotten. Not forgotten. It's not as if they've swept it aside and not dealt with something important, but the Roman Catholics these days are not talking about transubstantiation. They're talking about the presence of Christ. That's what Luther were talking about. And the Methodists, for their part, and the more radical Protestants, they don't talk about the real absence of Christ. They believe Christ is present too. But, in other words, there's a real agreement there that's really neat. And we're saying, let us find ways of bringing our churches to more frequent celebrations of communion. As often as once a week. As often as every Sunday. That's not too much. Now you might ask, what does the communion add to a service of the word, for instance? What does the sacrament add to a service where you have words that are sung in hymns, words that are prayed in prayers, words that are read from the Bible, words that are preached in the sermon, words in the benediction or blessings or liturgical responses or whatever. That's a word service. What's wrong with it? What's it lacking? Well, there's nothing wrong with it in a sense, but I'll tell you what it's lacking. It's lacking molecules. Molecules. See, in the communion, you walk up to the table, you eat and you drink, you digest, you metabolize even. And it's a picture of God wanting to reach you at the level of the atoms, the molecules. And it's a picture of God wanting to rescue the whole world to the level of the atoms and the molecules. And Christian faith is not just a top of the head thing, it's not just an intellectualizing. But it's concerned with people's health, it's concerned with the hunger in Africa or wherever, it's concerned with people blowing off limbs and landmines in Bosnia. You see what I'm saying? The molecules, in other words, the stuff is important. And that's what the sacraments add, and that's how the sacraments remind you. Water, of course, at baptism, and bread and cup at communion. They remind you of the incarnational, the word made flesh, the word in the stuff of human life. And our worship is word reductionist so very often. We reduce everything to words and to the meaning of words, whereas we have all of this human language to speak, including body language and gesture and music and... you heard the expression, those who sing pray twice. I like that. And same with gestures, I could come up in front of you and say, the Lord be with you. Or I could say, the Lord be with you, with a gesture of welcoming. And I do that, I'm speaking twice, aren't I? That's incarnational, sacramental. The stuff of the creation. Abraham Heschel, do you know that name? He was a Jewish rabbi, wonderful teacher. I think he just recently died. Anyhow, he says, in the Bible, everything, the stuff, the molecules, everything is either holy or not yet holy. Isn't that nice? Everything in the world is holy or not yet holy. Okay, finally, enlarging the sign. Martin Luther, as early as Martin Luther, you find these words. Luther wanted to enlarge the sign when he said, we shouldn't just be giving our people at the communion the bread, we should also give them the cup. You may know that for a couple of hundred years there, the cup was denied the lay people because it was too messy or too much problem. They just gave people the bread. And Luther says, no, let's give them the bread and the wine. Let's use a lot of water at baptism. We're coming out of an age of liturgical minimalism where people used to ask, what is the least we can get away with and it'll still be a valid sacrament? You know, three drops of moisture on a baby's brow will probably give us a valid baptism. But does it really picture what baptism is all about? Do you know Richard Kemmerer, this wild man who painted the ceiling of the village center? He's a crazy guy. He's in Leavenworth, and he has the Grunewald Theology. He's an artist, but he's also a lay theologian. I don't think he ever went to seminary, but he sure is a good theologian. Anyhow, he goes around the country helping churches to redesign their space. And he says, you look for a baptismal font in most churches, and you can hardly find it. You know, it's off in some corner somewhere. When you find it, he says, there's a great big wooden witch's hat cover on the top that gives two men a hernia when you try to remove it. And when you remove it, he says, what do you find? He says, you find an aluminum ashtray with a dead fly on the bottom. Now he says, that cannot possibly suggest the riches of baptism. I baptized my first and only so far grandchild a couple of months ago, and we took the baby's diaper off her and we dunked her in a big font that was as big as this sandpit here, and she squealed and we poured water over. It was wonderful. And then we put a cloth, you know, we wrapped her up and dried her off. But baptisms ought to have lots of water. That's enlarging the sign. I have a friend who says when a baptism is over with in a church, the janitor should know that something's happened. Got some mopping up to do. Let's use both bread and cup. And let's have real bread instead of these wafers that look like guppy food, you know. wafers were, again, they were invented in the Middle Ages, and they're very helpful and useful. You know, they don't go bad in the cupboard. You can store them for weeks and months and years, and they won't rot. But they don't look like bread either, do they? Or taste like bread. A friend of mine says you have to have two acts of faith to believe that Christ is present in the bread, and then to believe that it's bread in the first place. You know, it looks like styrofoam. So let's have a real loaf, and let's have real wine. Anyhow, I should quit. Those are the four characteristics that I see of the consensus that you can find here. Do you want to have a little conversation? We got some time. Go ahead.
There needs to be a sense of community.
Definitely.
And developing that. You talked about it in being inclusive, but we need to have an attitude of
welcome,
this everybody's responsibility, right, to be inclusive.
And there may be times when the church wants to split up into certain work groups or people who are interested in this or that. You know, I see nothing wrong with that. But there ought to be a time, too, when these people come together. And when we see, you know, the Democrats and Republicans can still be Christians. And that little kids and adults have some common human needs and some common human gifts to share. Mm-hmm. But that's, again, that's very tricky, isn't it? And very difficult to build that kind of community. I started a couples club in a church that I served, and I discovered within a couple of days that this was very offensive to the singles. So we had to work through that.
I was going to say, it just doesn't happen. You need to educate people.
Right. Constant education.
A lot of people in the church don't understand.
No.
Why they do it.
Why it's important.
Yeah. Why it's important.
Very true.
It just doesn't happen.
Constant education, and you can do it in sermons, and you can preach about it, and that's what I've done all my ministry, but you got to write it in the newsletter, and you got to put a little bulletin announcement in the Sunday bulletin, and you have to make a little comment every time you meet with the Ladies' Aid or with the Luther League or whoever, you know, boy, this is what we're doing, and this is why we do it. Constantly educating. Go ahead.
Well, help me understand, when they put the LBW together in the 70s, why the 4th century became the kind of the watermark.
Yeah, right.
For that.
Does it make sense to you?
No, it doesn't.
It does not make sense.
No.
What century would you choose?
I would. If they were putting a panel together in the 70s, they should have used the 20th century.
Ah, yeah, okay. Certainly, you know, I don't think this is antiquarian. I mean, I don't think it's going back and saying, let's try to replicate today what they were doing in the 4th century. I think they are saying, what kind of a world do we have? One of the fears, for instance, was we don't want to have happen in North America what has already happened now in a lot of Western Europe countries, where everybody thinks of themselves as Christian and nobody goes to church. Hatched, matched, and dispatched, you heard that? You know, hatched, you get the baby done, baptized, and then you never come to church again until it's time to get matched, married, and then you never come to church again until you're buried, dispatched. And that's the way it is in Scandinavia a lot of times. And boy, the churches are empty, not empty, but I mean, they got a big problem there. Where everybody thinks, oh, I'm a Lutheran, I'm a Swede, of course I'm a Lutheran, you know, or I'm a Norwegian, of course I'm Lutheran. And in France, you know, I'm Catholic, let's say. But boy, nobody takes it seriously. So these people, the people who put this book together, didn't want that to happen. And I don't think it will happen exactly the same way anyhow. But we see we live in a secular world and you got to come to terms with that. Now, maybe 4th century is not the best, but there are some precedents. In almost every age, there are some precedents in a previous age. You still may not be convinced, but you might think about it the next couple of days.
Yeah.
You can have a chance at me tomorrow or the next day.
Why not the age of Luther?
Uh-huh.
Was that looked at? Do you know?
Yeah. Somewhat different in that you're right at the end of the Middle Ages there, and in the Middle Ages the church was the guardian and the patron, you know, of almost everything in life. The church had invented hospitals, the church had invented universities, the church had invented Gothic architecture, you might say, you know, and Luther is just at the tail end of that. Let me think about that the next couple days, too, if you've got me thinking now. Go ahead.
That's a good question. I think you're kind of at the meat of something here. The hymn we sang before you came, well, first of all, the liturgy is basically Luther's liturgy.
Yes, but Luther's is Catholic. I mean,
yeah,
if you were to look at this book, it would look just like the modern Mass book.
But that did not. When did that come from? Did that come from? That didn't come from Constantine.
Well, it developed over centuries.
Yeah, the hymn we sang, my kids wouldn't relate to that music at
right.
all.
They would have to be initiated.
Yeah, and maybe not even to the words.
Yeah.
So
it's possible.
We've got a lot of Luther's hymns and that age in there. So
then what you need, if I may interrupt for a minute, what you need is a pastor or a choir director maybe who can point out and say, gee, look at that neat melody. And look how the second line of the melody is a repeat of the first line of the melody. And look at the wonderful words here, this poetry. You know, in other words, if you had some enthusiasm about what you're doing, and you could try to, make that contagious, that would be marvelous.
So I'm wondering, they say 10% of the people listen to classical music anymore.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm wondering whether, and I like what you're saying, but I wonder whether we're defeating ourselves in that one area. We don't need to adopt to what the culture has,
mm-hmm.
But is it necessary to teach poetry and to teach what some would say antiquated concepts and antiquated music to worship.
Yeah, yeah. I see your point. And you're making a good point. And this little volume here, and this little volume, hang on. I don't know when you arrived in Golden Village, but we use these two. And they're both, this is a Roman Catholic publication called Gather, and it's full of gospel songs and black African-American stuff. And this, too, this has, my goodness, Caribbean and African,
that's
wonderful
received.
African
it's
stuff.
Good.
And there's no reason why we can't have guitars on Sunday morning and drums. You know, I mean, that's part of the cultural experience of a lot of those people. So the ecumenical consensus that I'm that I'm describing to you wants to welcome all of that. Sure, this German chorales, they're great, but some of this stuff is great too. And we have to have leadership that is willing to embrace all of that. That's part of meaning Catholic, isn't it? Inclusive. We have to quit. But go ahead.
What I find is people want the God relationship. They don't want the
and we got to teach them both, don't we?
Right.
Yeah, that's good.
You know, you have to teach them both. Sure, it's you and Jesus, but it's also you and your brother and your sister. Even the brother and the sister who's a pain in the neck. We got to quit, friends. Hey, this is fun.
Thank you.
We'll see you tomorrow. We'll talk more about some of this tomorrow. Did you see the bear in the village at lunchtime?
Yes. Yes.
Wasn't that wild?
That was great.
Boy. Somebody says that it was such a bad winter and spring that the berry crop is not very good.
Yeah. And that, well,